Hi, it's Anushka. Today, it's been a real mess, but is there anything that can be done to save Universal Credit? And in opinion, Georgina Lawton on who gets to identify as black. We'll be back after this.
On Friday, Feeding Birkenhead, which is the most...
One of the most memorable moments in Parliament for me over the past year came from Frank Field, the Birkenhead MP.
Husband, wife and young child. The child was crying with hunger.
He described a father desperately trying to feed his family.
Father said it had been a lucky week for him because neighbours had taken pity and invited him to a funeral so that they could finish off the food.
He was speaking in a debate on Universal Credit about the type of people who might be moved on to the benefit. And he got a strong response from Tory MP Heidi Allen.
I'm humbled by the words from my honourable good friend from Birkenhead. No government is perfect, no benefit system is perfect, no debate, no motion is perfect, but by God we work together and make this better.
It was meant to be the biggest reform to benefits since the creation of the welfare state. But this week, the government was forced to pour cash in to prevent disaster. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, how did Universal Credit get into such a mess? And can it be fixed?
Universal Credit is one of the most ambitious reforms of social security we've ever seen. The fulfilment of a long-held dream of governments over the decades, which is how do you simplify this vast forest of benefits that make up our social security system?
Patrick Butler is the social policy editor at The Guardian. He explains how universal credit is meant to work.
There's six big benefits, and they include things like unemployment benefit, which is called Job Seekers Allowance, housing benefit, which is your top-up for rent, and tax credits, which is a kind of a support for people on low income. So it takes six major benefits and it rolls them up into one monthly payment to claimants.
And you've said that fixing this is like the holy grail of welfare policy. What's the problem that politicians wanted to solve?
It was just fast and it was complicated. Claimants often didn't understand the rules and the people administering the system didn't always understand the rules just because there were so many of them. So okay. They're really complex.
So let's be honest, there was a real problem.
Everyone accepts there was a real problem. In fact, New Labour looked at this, ironically. So under Gordon Brown, New Labour looked at a universal credit type reform. And they concluded that it was too expensive and it was too complicated and the IT didn't exist. So they basically shelved it.
OK, so Labour decide not to go for this while they're in power before 2010. But look, in the Tory party, someone is eyeing it up.
Well, Ian Duncan Smith, he used to be a leader of the Conservative Party. He's now languishing on the backbenches. He has a passion about solving poverty. And one of the ways he thinks will solve poverty is to get people off benefits, which he believes are essentially morally corrupting and trap people in poverty.
We seem happy to leave a whole group of society doing nothing actively or contributing to society at all. Just simply taking from society.
And one of the ways which he and his colleagues think that they will do that is to develop a single benefit system. Universal credit becomes Ian Duncan Smith's obsession. So through his think tank, the Centre for Social Justice, they develop the idea of universal credit, which is going to be this new dynamic system that is going to get people out of poverty.
So universal credit is a massive reform that's trying to simplify the benefit system. But it's also got this moral element about helping people back into work. And it's designed by a former Tory leader who is on the right of the party. What was driving Ian Duncan Smith? Was it about helping poor people?
Whether he has, in fact, helped the cause of poor people is open to debate. Many people will say no. But what you can't do is doubt his intentions, I suspect. He's there in 2009. He's on the backbenches. He's touting the idea of universal credit around. No one is particularly interested. He takes it to the then Shadow Work and Pensions Secretary, Theresa May, who is now our current Prime Minister. And from all accounts, Theresa May takes a look at this and thinks that this is very risky, very expensive. And
oh, so she agrees with Gordon Brown.
She sort of pushes it away. Right. So at that point, 2009, it looks like universal credit isn't going to happen.
Good afternoon, everyone.
A year later, the Conservatives form a coalition with the centrist Liberal Democrats.
To our coalition agreement, a Liberal Democrat Conservative government that we have negotiated.
Ian Duncan Smith is on holiday in Florence with his wife, and he unexpectedly gets a call from David Cameron, who was the Prime Minister at the time, saying, would you like to do the job of Work and Pensions Secretary? Ian Duncan Smith is not expecting this at all. But of course he realises this is my big chance to introduce universal credit. So he takes the job, and all of a sudden universal credit, this mad, ambitious, expensive scheme, is back on the table. But its problems are only just starting.
So I remember 2010, I was working on The Observer covering politics, and I seem to remember that a lot of stories we got were basically about these meetings where Treasury officials and DWP officials were clashing with each other. The Treasury, presumably, because they think, hang on, this is just going to cost too much money.
Well, what happens is, over those first 3 years, everything that can go wrong goes wrong. So the IT collapses and has to be rewritten. No one's quite sure what the end design point is. They're kind of making it up as they go along. The more they do that, the more problems they discover with it. To give you an idea of the scale of universal credit, there's going to be 7 million people on this credit by the time that it's fully rolled out. They are going to receive around £60 billion a year in benefits. 2013, 3 years in, universal credit is teetering on the edge. The Treasury is getting really frustrated at this point. The people that save it are essentially the Liberal Democrats in coalition at that critical point where it could have been sunk. When it starts being rolled out to people, 2014, 2015, this is where they start piloting universal credit. And this is when you start to get the first stories back of people who are coming up against universal credit and finding it has a pretty dismal effect on their lives. So these problems start emerging. At that point, you're thinking, is this just teething problems, or could there be something a bit more fundamental going on? They reset the schedule. So something that was supposed to be up and running by 2013 and fully implemented by 2017, they push back the delivery date.
And then we have the 2015 budget. By now, the Tories are ruling without the Lib Dems, and the Chancellor, George Osborne, has no constraints. And there he goes. He unveils the ultimate austerity budget.
Tax credits and universal credit on the lowest income households will reduce the welfare bill by £9 billion a year by 2019-20.
And one of the things he said was that people on benefits can never be better off than people in work.
The system should not support lifestyles and rents that are not available to taxpayers.
And you actually start to hear the MPs in the House shouting, because they know immediately what this means. A huge cut to benefits.
Order! This House will come to order.
So, Patrick, that's £3.2 billion effectively being taken out of universal credit. What did it mean for the policy?
By taking £3.2 billion out of universal credit, he's making it less generous. So 2016, Ian Duncan Smith resigns, partly because he's so hacked off at the cuts to universal credit. Also, that's the point when I start to get reports from food banks and from charities saying, do you know what's happening? Isn't this outrageous? And I start to get emails as well.
And we actually spoke to a woman who wrote to The Guardian about this last week. She's going through this situation. She didn't want to be named, so let's call her Alison. She explained how she initially became unemployed.
In my late 30s, I suffered a bit of a breakdown. I had severe depression and generalised anxiety disorder that was quite debilitating. I couldn't work, but I did improve over time.
So Alison managed to get back into part-time work, and she was also being paid tax credits. And then her health worsened and she tried to cut down her hours temporarily to below 16 hours a week. And suddenly the tax credits were taken off her.
I didn't know that was coming. And I thought, oh dear, right, OK, well, I'll go and increase my hours and see if I can get my working tax credit payments back. But unfortunately, I'm in an area that's been moved on to universal credit, so I can't go back on working tax credit. It's not an option anymore.
There was a lot of confusion, and then after a couple of months, she applied for universal credit and realised she'd be losing £200 a month.
It's been harder to pay my bills. I'm in rent arrears, and I've got a pretty big overdraft. I'm trying to run a really tight budget at the moment, being really careful about what money I spend on food. So I have a lot of sort of weighing up in my mind to do about how many hours can I do, what type of work can I do without having a mental health issue as a result of that. So it's a balancing act. I've got to try and find the right situation for myself.
What happened there that caused that switch for her?
What happens is what the Department for Work and Pensions would call a change in circumstances. She got ill. Her circumstances changed. She couldn't work as hard as she was working before. And what this shows is how little protection there is. If she hadn't got ill, she'd still be on tax credit. She'd still be £200 better off. So although politicians are saying no one's going to be worse off under universal credit, what people are finding is actually they are worse off on universal credit if their circumstances change.
And a big worry about universal credit is that people have to wait several weeks to receive their first payment.
So if you think about that, this is a Social Security benefit that's designed to help the most vulnerable in their hour of need, which has built into it an income shock. So in effect, it's saying we will give you universal credit as an unemployment benefit. You've lost your job, you've had an accident, you're ill, you can't work, but we're going to make you wait.
And did they have to do that?
They didn't have to do that at all. But what they wanted to do, the theory behind this, was the welfare system, the benefits system, should try and mirror the world of work. And their idea of the world of work is that most people are paid monthly salaries and you're paid a month in arrears. Now, one of the reasons this doesn't work in practice is that many people on universal credit are poor. So they don't have savings to cover that first 6-7 weeks.
To feed themselves, to put clothes on their kids.
They don't have any income whatsoever. So all of a sudden, what you're getting is people turning up at food banks because they've been referred because they have no money coming through. You've got people who are running up debt. You've got people who, because their housing benefit is stopped, no one is paying your rent. So the landlord is saying, well, I'm going to start evicting you. So all this is causing huge stress for huge amounts of people who simply don't have the capacity to deal with this kind of thing.
And all the time, political pressure building up too. We've had two former prime ministers, the Conservative John Major, talking about poll tax style chaos.
Saying that if you have people who face that degree of loss, that is not something that the majority of the British population would think of as fair.
And so finally, the government takes action?
Well, last week we heard from the Chancellor, Philip Hammond, in the budget. He set out £2.7 billion for extra protections for people moving to universal credit and more generous work allowances. We heard this week from Esther McVeigh setting out more details of those protections. I think there's an interesting tonal change from the Department of Work and Pensions. It shows they are listening to the critics. They're saying they want to get this absolutely right before they push ahead with the next phase. So will all this work? Well, it might, but it's not going to guarantee that there will be no hardship for claimants in future. And it doesn't really answer broader questions about the deliverability of universal credit, whether they can actually do what they say they want to do.
And it's not calmed all Tory nerves. I mean, Heidi Allen, who earlier in the programme we heard crying, said, look, it's good, but it's not enough.
The announcements today will only fix the symptoms, not the cause. We need to be honest and really sort out universal credit by restoring all work allowances for families with children and disabilities. And we must deal with the 5-week initial wait. That is what will keep families out of food banks.
I think Heidi Allen is a very good critic of universal credit because she's someone who essentially believes in the principle of universal credit. But through her work on the Work and Pensions Committee, She knows exactly what the harsh realities of universal credit can be.
Do you think universal credit should be kept in place?
Well, going back 10 years, you could probably say it maybe wasn't a good idea to launch this into a period of austerity when there was no money around. But as Philip Hammond said...
Mr. Deputy Speaker, universal credit is here to stay.
Well, if it is here to stay, then the government needs to know, needs to realise it has to put more money into it. Government needs to realise that there are a whole load of structural problems with universal credit which need to be fixed.
Patrick, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Trust me, no one knows more about universal credit than Patrick Butler. Read his coverage on our website. And if, like Alison, you ever want to write into the letters desk, email them at guardian.letters@theguardian.com. After the break, in opinion, is it okay to choose your racial identity? Welcome back. Now, Georgina Lawton on the controversy surrounding the white man who was awarded a grant reserved for ethnic minorities.
So Anthony Lennon is a British theatre director whose name was trending on Twitter at the weekend as it had emerged that he had received grant money from the Arts Council, and the grant money was for one of four theatre directors or people of colour in theatre, but he's actually white. He's obviously received this grant money and identifies as mixed race or black. He's been quite open about his heritage in the past, but he was born to white Irish parents in Kilburn. He grew up in Kilburn and Paddington. In 1990, he was in a documentary on the BBC. It was a docudrama, and he was speaking about the way in which he's been racialised growing up.
So, Anthony, where are your parents from, man?
They're from Ireland.
Not many black people in Ireland.
OK, let's clear all this up. Both of my parents are white.
No, man, I don't believe.
And so are their parents, and so are their parents, and so are their parents.
I don't believe.
What, you don't believe like I'm lying or something?
From pictures, Anthony Lennon has got light skin, he's got high cheekbones. When his hair is grown out, it's quite curly, and he could definitely pass as a mixed race person. As far as I'm aware, he was finding it hard to obtain roles in the acting world, and identifying as black or identifying as mixed race was one way in which that he could further his career. He's also given himself an African middle name, a Yoruba name. I think people are angry online for a number of reasons. Firstly, there's a lot of black creatives trying to receive grant money in the theatre world and the creative industries who are angry that they believe that it's gone to a white man or a man with, you know, white privilege, white parents, white networks. It reminded people of the situation of Rachel Dolezal, who is a white American woman who was passing as African American and was exposed in 2015. She held a position for the NAACP. So she was actually working for the advancement of black and colour people in America. So when she was exposed as posing as a African-American, people were outraged. So it was a huge furore in the States. For most of my life, I believed that my parents were my parents, even though I had lots of questions, lots of anxieties around the fact that they were white and I'm mixed race looking. But we just didn't talk about race. I kind of existed in a raceless space for most of my childhood. And sometimes I was encouraged to identify as white. So I took on this kind of white psychological mindset. But then when I step outside of my immediate family and I'd go further into London or into diverse parts of the country where there are more black people, more brown people, I realised that I was getting racialised as a black woman, as a mixed race woman. It wasn't until my dad got ill that I actually decided to speak to him about race. And then after he passed away, I processed a DNA test, which found that myself and my dad weren't related and that my mum had had an affair with a black man that I don't really know anything about. People would say, oh, you look Eritrean or you look Caribbean or you look... you know, like this. So I kind of flirted with multiple identities, and in that way I can relate to what Anthony Lennon's story could be about. It could be that he is born to white parents, but he looks mixed race, and he's kind of flirted with the idea of having a black identity and a white identity. And I think that is definitely possible. But at the same time, it could be that he has co-opted blackness in a way that perhaps I never did. I wasn't permitted access to a lot of white spaces outside of my immediate community. People would racialise me all the time as black, whereas I think Anthony Lennon has kind of been able to choose I think the issue with Anthony Lennon's story, and similarly with Rachel Dolezal, she is confirmed as being a white woman, they're hijacking what could be a very nuanced, important, complex debate on racial fluidity and transracialism. I know from the many people that have got in contact with me who have been raised the same way I have, who have been lied to about their identity, adoptees who have been denied access to their heritage. These people know what it really is like to be transracial, to kind of grow up detached from your birth culture and never quite fit into one culture or another and never feel like you quite belong. And I think with stories like this, there's a danger of that narrative being hijacked by white people or white passing people who just feel like they want to be black. And that's not what transracialism is. That's not what racial fluidity is. You can't just wake up and decide to be black or Asian or white. It's a much more layered, nuanced experience.
You can read Georgina's column at theguardian.com. My thanks to Alison, Patrick Butler and Georgina Lawton. Today's producers are Elizabeth Cassin, Brenna Daldorf, Leah Green and Mithali Rao. Sound design is by Axel Cocoutier. The executives are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. See you tomorrow.